Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus, here with Nate Mavis, and our guest this week is the wonderful Martin Harris, who blogs as Short Stacked Seamus over at Hardboiled Poker. Martin is an academic who studies the history of poker and the role that poker plays in American culture, so it's a pretty great conversation that we'll get to have with him.
Martin's a thoughtful man, and it'll be a pleasure to talk to him. We're going to talk about reporting tournaments, about being a freelance writer, a poker blogger, and about teaching poker in universities, and what he thinks poker has to tell us about culture.
That's right. But first, we're going to have our normal mailbag segment, and I think we're actually going to end up discussing two topics this week. First off, we have a question that's coming to us from Sean, one of our listeners, and he had a question relating to our interview with Jason Strasser last week when we were talking about the ways that poker can prepare people to work in finance and other places in the real world. And one of the things, Jason was drawing a distinction between some people who come into finance out of like a real elite education background. So they've been to the Ivy Leagues and they've never really had anything go wrong for them academically or career-wise before. And it's kind of inevitable that something will, I guess, in the finance world, like in poker, you know, sometimes you're going to have big losses. And there are certain people who just weren't psychologically prepared for that. So Sean asked us, is there any way that you can support or help people who are on that Harvard 4.0 GPA track to get onto the other track where the people who have the poker background who are more accepting about the fact that things might go wrong? He says that I asked because it's kind of a cool question, but practically I'm currently managing someone at work who fits the bill for the first category, and it kind of gets me down to see him taking things hard when they fail, as well as it sucks that it creates more work for others, i.e. me. And the added layer of complexity here is the boss-worker dynamic.
So Andrew and I think that's a great question, and we would love to answer it. And there's just one problem, which is that neither of us is remotely qualified to answer it. We don't have much business experience, and we have almost zero management experience in business. So we thought, we have listeners. Certainly some of our listeners have management experience and business experience. Why don't you write in and tell us how to manage some of these quote-unquote Harvard 4.0 guys who are having trouble learning how to fail, dealing with failure, and just generally becoming more meta-rational.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought one of the nice things about being a poker player was that I didn't work for anyone else. And in my brief experience of kind of quasi having someone work for me, I realized that that's actually not all that great either. There's a lot of headaches that come along with that. So hopefully you all can help each other out here, because unfortunately neither Nate nor I is in a position to offer much advice to Sean.
So write in podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Write us all your questions, all your comments. And please, if you have management experience or if you think you know how to manage people who are who have meta-rational deficiencies but are very good in other respects, please tell us. We would be interested to learn what you know. And we'll read some answers on the air, and you will have our sincere thanks.
The one thought that I did have on this regard, and this is partly because I met Sean when I was in London, and I went to a pub actually with him and a few of his coworkers. So I have a little bit of a sense of what the company culture is like where he works. And at least for him, I feel like maybe having an actual company poker game could be a pretty viable thing. It seems like something that would go over well at their company, and especially if there were prizes provided by the management. Rather than saying, you know, how can I simulate these good things that poker can teach people, you know, why not just use poker? I imagine it could be a pretty good way of bringing your workplace together and a good social activity for people to enjoy, maybe even some team building going on, as long as you keep it light and fun and give people a chance to fail at the poker table and see how that happens.
Why just talk about failure when you can actually make them fail pretty often, because everybody fails at poker. So. Okay. So that's our mailbag segment for this week. Again, please write in podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And for our strategy segment this week, Andrew and I wanted to try something a little different. Rather than just dissect one hand, we wanted to talk about something more general. In particular, something that we think a lot of people are curious about and a lot of people could improve, namely improving their live reads at a poker table, what sometimes get called physical tells or live reads or just physical information generally.
Do we have to restrict ourselves to physical information? Because I'm kind of bad at that.
No.
Great. Because I think one common question is, where do you start? I mean, you can read books like, I think, both Kara's Book of Tales and
Navarro.
That's right, and Navarro's book. And those both have good information generally, and not just about specific tales to look for, although they have that, but also more broadly about how to interpret tales, just principles of why the body gives off tales and what different types of behaviors might mean. And all that is pretty good information to have, but it can be really overwhelming when you sit down at a table and all of a sudden there's eight other people and you're trying to watch them, or nine other people, depending on the casino you're at, and you're trying to keep an eye on all of them at the same time, and there's actual poker to be played, so you're trying to think about how to play your hand as well. I think it can be pretty overwhelming. And then on top of that, it's live poker, it goes pretty slowly. You only have so many opportunities to observe these people. So I think a good question is, where do you start? You know, if you can't take in everything and you're just getting started learning how to interpret people's behavior at the table, what are some of the first things that you look for? And who do you look at first? Do you try to watch all eight, nine people at once?
So one principle of poker is that most of your money comes from the weakest players. How much you're winning from your weakest opposition matters usually a lot more than how much you're winning from your average opposition. So the first thing to do, especially because the weakest players often give off the most physical information, is, I think, to focus on them. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's important anyway. I mean, to identify pretty early, we all know that saying, if you can't spot the fish at the table. So I think it is smart to identify where is the money going to come from. And then that's already a good habit to be in, to identify like who are the people at the table making the biggest mistakes. And then, yeah, I agree that you'd want to keep an eye on them. And the other place that a lot of your money comes from at the table is from on the people on your right. So you've also, I'm sure, heard the saying that money flows clockwise around the table, proceeding in order of position. So you're probably going to make more money from the guy on your right than from the guy on your left, and more than from the guy across the table from you. You're going to play the most pots with the guy on your immediate right and the guy on your immediate left. So I think it also makes sense to try to keep an eye on them, because you'll have the most opportunities to use any information that you are able to determine about those players.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, especially at a tournament when your table might not break for a whole day and when you can't just get up and go get dinner when you want, you are at war with the two people on your left and the two people on your right. You should be trying to destroy them and learn everything you can about them.
That's actually one of the first things that I look for. I mean, to jump ahead a little bit to answering that question, is whether how much fight a person has in them, especially when it comes to people on my left. That's a question I like to answer early on, is how hard is this guy fighting for pots versus how much is he just kind of playing his hands. So if I raise from the cutoff, is he only going to 3-bet me on the button if he has one of a certain category of hands? Or is he going to 3-bet me just to put me in my place, or because he has the button and I have the cutoff and he knows that being in position is a good opportunity? Is he going to be looking for weakness on my part to attack? Or is he going to make the decision about whether and how to play his hand based primarily on his own cards?
I think that's important. I also think that the live read gathering device that we talked about a few weeks ago, I think that's very valuable. The one where you just sort of narrate everything to yourself.
Yeah, just go around the table and sort of say inside of your head, okay, player one has folded, player two has raised, he looks angry, player three has, just, you know, being not even trying to process everything, just being conscious of it, letting it flow through your brain. Hopefully your subconscious will pick up on some important cues.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I think one sort of general principle that I always try to use is trying to figure out people's motivations, especially if you want to go beyond what just the person's bet means in a vacuum. If you want to do something like pick up reads and pick up physical information, I think you have to figure out why that person is playing poker. Why does he play poker at all instead of, you know, playing cribbage or Yahtzee? Why is he playing poker that day? And even what are his goals that hand? I think that's often the key to figuring out what a certain bet light might mean or what a certain physical tick might mean. And I think it's something that people don't pay quite enough attention to. And you can figure it out easily enough. I think there are, especially around World Series of Poker times, you get a lot of business owners who you know, have been very successful in business and believe themselves to be very good at poker and sort of think that they have a general formula for excellence that they can easily apply in any different domain. And I think, you know, I mean, many of them are quite good and a lot of them are actually just really lovely people to talk to and I enjoy their company. But, you know, this is something that you ought to know. If somebody is playing poker deep down at the fundamental level to sort of prove that he's more excellent than other people, you ought to know that, and that'll have a bearing on how you interpret his decisions later.
What other kind of goals do you have in mind? I mean, are we talking about things as generic, as broad as to win money, or what do you mean when you say what are people's motivations for playing?
To win money, to get unstuck, to prove to themselves that they can be successful at something. I mean, so in tournaments, this can be something like to make the next day, to cash, to stay alive in the tournament so they don't have to go hang out with their screaming kids. I mean, this happens. I mean,
yeah. and you'll see the people also who their goal shifts at some point, especially if someone at the table antagonizes them, where their goal becomes to take money away from that guy or bluff that guy. Or that's an interesting one. When someone is caught in a bluff, there are two big ways of responding to that, and it's interesting to see which direction somebody goes. There are some people who are kind of embarrassed by it, and then they think that like their table image is ruined, and from now on they're not going to bluff anymore. And then there are other people who are embarrassed by it, and therefore they want to prove that they can do it. You know, when one fails, that just inspires them that much more to be like, oh, I'm a good player. I know how to bluff. I'll make the next one work.
I think you forgot response three, which is to try hard to claim that the person who called the bluff made a bad play.
I think that's perfectly compatible with one and two.
Okay. I guess also there's a converse to the sort of aggression and trying to dominate people, which is trying to have a social time. And there are people who will, you know, they won't check raise if they think it would be really mean. They won't. They're primarily there to participate in a social game, like a game of bridge on Sunday morning or something like that. And
that's right. Those people do not value bet thinly on the river at all. Like, for them, betting is about protecting the best hand. It's not like betting the river is greedy in their eyes.
Yeah, they often tend to be. I mean, a lot of these people actually are bridge players, I think, and a lot of them have this habit that's very good in bridge betting, which is trying to communicate information with your bets instead of in poker, where you often try to hide information with your bets. So, I mean, especially their river betting is often closely correlated with like the absolute strength of their hand.
So that's like, you know, I raised big to let him know that I had a pocket pair so he would fold ace X, king X sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, I had two small pair and seven card stud and the other person hadn't made any aggressive actions yet. And two pair gives you a license to keep on betting until someone aggresses against you. You know, I think this bridge player phenomenon of actually trying to communicate information with your bets gets into a broader psychological phenomenon, which is players trying to give away information with their bets. I think you see this a lot at the World Series or generally in high pressure, high stakes situations, whatever counts as high pressure or high stakes for that person, which is that they start trying to make their poker play reflect in a very precise way what they have and what they think. Like, they really want to produce a justification to themselves for playing the hand the way they did. And what this does is they start really giving off a lot of bet sizing information, giving off a lot of physical tells, because in their quest to make their behavior intelligible to themselves, they end up expressing the value of their hand in a very precise way with what they're doing. So, I mean, especially in the main event, almost every year you'll find a couple people who are just giving away way too much bet sizing information just because they're trying to sort of make the perfect play and make their action just reflect in minute detail the quality of their hand and the situation that they're in.
Do you have an example of that?
What's a good example of this? So here's a hand. It's very simple. It's from the main event, day four from 2010. And there's a raise and a call out of the blind. And the flop comes down ragged. And the blind checks. And the pre-flop raiser bets. And the guy in the middle folds. And then the guy out of the small blind makes a big raise. Okay. And he had a set. There was a flush draw on board. And it's a very simple hand, but my conjecture then is that he just couldn't bear the thought of not protecting his hand enough. Like, balance went out the window. Fundamentals of poker went out the window. It wasn't even so much that he didn't want to get drawn out on by the flush. It was that he couldn't look at himself in the mirror if he thought that he hadn't raised enough to protect himself from the flush. Mm-hmm. I can also think of a guy I played against that year who had like four or five different preflop bet sizes. And when he was about to raise it before the flop, he would actually look down at his chips for a while and play with them for a while, then raise a different amount every time. And between that and like the way that he looked at his hand, he had this like small tick where, and a lot of people do this, where if their first card is good, then they sort of sweat the second one a little bit more, right? So it folds to late middle position, and he does the sweating thing, and then he sort of looks down, and then he picks up a certain amount, and it's like slightly bigger than usual, but not so big that I would think he had queens or jacks or something like that. And it's just like, oh, I bet that that raise means that it's like ace jack, and he really likes his hand, but he doesn't want to raise so small that he could let in like 8-7 suited or something like that. So you think that he has a good card because he sweated the second one. And you also think that he's happy about his hand, but he doesn't really want to call. So then it starts to look like ace 10, ace jack, ace queen, something like that. And this is something that you can do. I mean, it's a huge edge, right? Because if you really understand your opponent and what he's thinking, these can be very reliable. And imagine being in a tournament and knowing that the other guy has ace jack offsuit. I mean, before anything else has happened. I mean, that's a big advantage, right?
Yeah, I think it's significant that most of what we're talking about is about figuring out a thought process or something that'll help you to interpret a number of different actions a person takes,
yeah,
rather than, you know, when his hand shakes, it means he's bluffing, or, you know, when he swallows hard, it means he has a value hand. That kind of stuff, I don't even know how reliable it ultimately is, but it requires a lot of observation to get. I don't think it's the sort of thing that's consistent. I certainly don't think it's consistent across people. You know, like, you can just say anytime anyone swallows hard, it means that person is weak.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it's necessarily consistent within a single person. Like, you could say a single person always has this give and tell. Even if it is, I think it would take a lot of observation. I mean, maybe over the course of an entire day of playing at a high-stakes tournament, you could pick it up. But if you just sit for a few hours with someone in a cash game, it's going to be hard to pick up something like that. So I think the more valuable way to spend your observational powers and time is looking at something that'll be applicable in a wide range of situations, rather than trying to decipher what any given little tick a person has could mean. I think trying to figure out something like his thought process or his general approach to the game, like Nate's been talking about, or as I was saying, is he a fighter? Is he a guy who's trying to win every pot? Or is he primarily concerned about playing his cards? Because that also affects things like how often he plays back in a continuation bet, what it means when he plays back in a continuation bet. Is he raising because it's a board that he thinks I'll bluff a lot? Or is he raising because he thinks he has the best hand?
And just one caveat to what we said earlier, I think that both Caro and Navarro fall a little bit into the trap of the sort of magic bullet theory of tells, where there are these culturally constant ticks that people have that can be mapped in a fairly reliable way to hand strength or something like that. So we do recommend these books, but, you know, like a lot of poker literature, be skeptical of any claims to a magic bullet and read it actively. Mm-hmm.
But I do think some of the broader advice, like, you know, Caro has that real famous advice, the strong means weak and weak means strong. That's the kind of thing that I have in mind when I talk about broader, how to interpret, because he gives a bunch of different individual examples of that. Yeah. But I think it's a good idea of like a philosophy of tells, or a way of interpreting a wide range of actions that a person could make. And that's been helpful to me. You know, I guess I probably could name a number of the individual tells in the Caro book, but I haven't really used them all that much. But what I have quite a bit used that general philosophy of, you know, is he trying to look strong or trying to look weak? I think that's a real helpful thing.
One little slogan I have that's a bit cheesy but works for me is that it's in the adverbs, not the nouns. You know, it's in how people do what they do, not that they do what they do.
Yeah, that's a good way to put that.
With some of the younger players who play quite well and are actually really good at also hiding information live, one place where they maybe aren't so good as consistently is in a tournament with in shoving and reshoving situations. oftentimes they'll open shove or reshove like out of a sense of obligation because they sort of feel like the math demands it. And, you know, oftentimes they're actually correct to do this. Like shoving Jack nine suited for 12 big blinds from the cutoff is the correct play, whether or not it feels good, right? But, you know, sometimes they'll reshove for 25 big blinds over a tight razor when they shouldn't. And oftentimes it's out of this desire to be, you know, a properly aggressive kind of player. And
well, I had ace jack, I had to.
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes the feeling of reluctant obligation is something that you can see in a guy, even somebody who's very good generally at hiding information.
Yeah, so we're going to keep an eye on the weakest players at the table. We're going to keep an eye on the people to our immediate left, our immediate right, and we're going to be looking more for things that help us to interpret any of their actions and to interpret their general reason for being there at the table and their general approach to poker, more so than looking for the meaning of any individual tick or movement that person makes.
And when in doubt, just narrate the action to yourself.
So good stuff. And once again, this is another good thing to email us about, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Martin Harris joins us today. You probably know him as Short Stacked Seamus. His blog, Hardboiled Poker, is one of the most widely read poker blogs on the internet. Martin's also a freelance writer, a novelist, and an adjunct associate professor at University of North Carolina, Charlotte, where he teaches a class called Poker in American Film and Culture. So what do you do with all your free time? You've got only four jobs.
And they're all poker related, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, how did that happen? I mean, you're kind of like a poker professional who doesn't play for a living.
That's right. Somehow weaseled my way into making money from poker without doing so at the tables. My background is as an academic, and so I went and got graduate degrees and was a full-time English professor for many years, and then kind of slid over into poker, playing poker and just, you know, for small stakes, and then starting a blog and writing about poker more and more, and then all these other jobs kind of came from that detour.
So the blog was the first kernel. Like you're an English professor, you start a poker blog, and then you start getting freelance offers, or did you decide you wanted to sell yourself as a freelancer?
I was pretty lucky. I started the blog just for fun and then got a few, it took a while, but I got some readers and then got some people asking me if I would write for them. And so that's really where it came from. And it wasn't begun with an idea of starting some sort of freelance career, which ended up happening.
When was this that you started doing poker freelance writing? Like what year?
My blog, I started Hardboiled Poker in 2006, and then it was the next year, 2007, that Poker News actually asked me to write some things. That was the first year that they sent people to cover the World Series of Poker, and they needed somebody to kind of cover for the regular people while they were in Vegas and maybe write a few articles while they were gone. And so that's where it began.
So you were not on the WSOP team in 2006?
No, 2006, I think Card Player did it. And then 2007 was Poker News' first year. And 2008, I ended up going to Vegas. And so I wasn't there until their second year at the series.
And you've done it every year since then, though, right?
I have, actually. So 5 years.
What's that like? I mean, are you working mostly when you're out there, or do you have time to like hang out with all the other journalists and players? And I mean, do you go to the parties?
It's pretty intense. I've been to a few of the parties. You know, I got to see Snoop Dogg, done some fun stuff along the way, but it's a lot of work. We end up working probably 5 or 6 days a week, and maybe even 7 sometimes. And they're long days where we go in, you know, pretty much when the tourneys start, and we're there until they end. And so it's pretty intense.
And you continue to blog on top of that, which I find impressive, right? You're still updating Hardboiled Poker at the same time that you're doing all this writing for your employer.
Yeah, I've been pretty stubborn about that. I started a few years back, I kind of gave myself a schedule where I was posting every weekday. And then when I go on these trips to either the World Series or to other tournaments that I've covered, I usually try to like give a little travel report as well. And so that means getting up early and you know, giving an hour or two to that before I start a long work day.
What are some of the other challenges of trying to cover the WSOP?
You know, aside from just we're working these very long days. And so we'll work. Generally, what happens is those of us who are live blogging, say for Poker News, the kind of thing I've been doing, we get assigned to one tournament. And so when I come in that day, I'm only following one of the several tournaments that's going on. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to try to present in a somewhat comprehensive way what's happening from the beginning to the end of that day. And usually it's only a very small number of people who are given this task. And so, you know, there are situations where it'll be me, I might even be by myself, or I might be with just one other blogger, and we're there on day one of a tournament with, you know, 1,000, 2,000 players or something. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to sort of give an idea what's happening in the tournament from the beginning to the end of that day. And so the challenge, you know, that's one challenge, is to just try to be, you know, to present enough information that it's a reasonable report of what's happening, with highlights and you know, trying to sort of find ways to keep it interesting as you tell the story.
Is there a level of like proofreading that stands between you and the whole world when you submit these reports?
That was the case once upon a time. I think when there was a little bit more in the way of resources. And in fact, I've actually done that as well. I did that before I started going out to the World Series for Poker News. That first summer in 07, I was doing some of that proofreading. And so I was at home actually watching the reports go up and just reading them and, you know, making sure, you know, everything was spelled correctly. And if there was a card that was duplicated or something like that, I could let the reporter know and we could make sure it got fixed. But that's not the case anymore. We're all kind of on our own with those reports. And so we're trying to, you know, make sure there's a way for us to, like with any blog, you can sort of publish something, not to the world, but just so you can see it. And so we'll always try to do that. We'll always try to read over something before we publish it. But then, you know, mistakes still happen. And so we end up, if we catch those, we try to edit them as quickly as possible.
And you've traveled a bit to cover some other tournaments besides the WSOP, right?
Yeah, I've been to a few. I haven't traveled as much as some of my colleagues have, but I've been as far away as I went to that European Poker Tour event that they had in Kiev in the Ukraine. And I've been down to South America a few times, to Lima and Uruguay. I had a chance to go to Marrakesh in Morocco for an event, and other places in Vegas and Atlantic City. And so I've gotten to do some of that.
So what do you think about the globalization of poker? So you teach about poker culture, and it's, you know, it's a very American institution. I once read that baseball, jazz, and poker are the three really American things. And I imagine as somebody who's trying to teach about poker, that the globalization of it is an interesting feature of the culture. I mean, do you think that it's becoming a more global phenomenon? And if so, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think definitely. And it's interesting because in my class, it's called Poker and American Film and Culture, and it's in this American Studies program. And so we necessarily put a lot of emphasis on the American part of that, and how, you know, a lot of the first part of the course, in fact, is reading and recognizing this argument that's contained in that phrase that you just said, that poker is an especially American game. And why is that? Like, what is American about it? And so we're spending a lot of energy looking at that. And then even through the course, like all of our texts, we're kind of mainly sticking with U.S. movies and U.S. works of literature and other things that are all American. But it's hard not to continually realize this, that it's not just an American game, that it's a global game. The situation with online poker has kind of created this really kind of weird situation where America is not really part of that at the moment. And watching sort of the rest of the world, I think it's becoming even the situation is becoming even more I guess, evened out between America and the rest of the world as far as poker goes, because you're having online poker having its influence everywhere except America. And so when America hopefully finally does return to the online poker game, I think it'll, you know, we'll discover that there are places like Russia and these other countries where poker is that, you know, they're producing many great players who are going to be on a level field with the Americans.
That was a big thing that jumped out at me. You know, I hadn't played online much between the Scoop and the WCOOP, and then I was just playing the WCOOP a few weeks ago, and there were a lot, like, I would just, when I encountered someone who seemed like a good player, I would look to see what country they were from. And the two that really jumped out at me as places, the last time I had been online, I didn't see quite so many people, was Ukraine and Portugal. For whatever reason, I seem to be encountering a lot of good players from those two countries.
Yeah, Ukraine is interesting. Like I mentioned that I had a chance to go there. And at that time, that was 3 years ago, and it was kind of a one-off thing. They haven't been back to Kiev for this tournament. But there was a lot of talk at that time about poker and Ukraine. And I think a kind of, you know, a little bit of momentum starting to build there. And then, you know, now we look back a few years later, and yeah, there are a lot of players. And Russia, too, you look at those lists of, you just look at the leaderboards of those events on PokerStars, and there's a ton of those guys.
I think Alexander Kostritsyn might be the single toughest person I've ever played live poker against.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's a demon.
So I wanted to ask more about teaching university courses. I'm a grad student, so I teach undergrads. And I'm always surprised by what they react to, what gets them excited, what prompts useful thought in them, what they like to read. I can never, I still can't predict this correctly. I've looked over your syllabus, and it's, first of all, it's remarkably well chosen. You have pretty much all the good stuff and almost nothing that isn't good on there. What lights your students fire? What gets them excited?
It's interesting. It's a pretty, that syllabus I've got kind of, it's a fun class to teach because it's got a pretty good variety of readings and texts that we're focusing on. And I describe the course to the students as it's kind of several courses in one. And we start out as kind of a history class, and we read James McManus's book, Cowboys Full, and some other kind of primary texts and other essays and things, and kind of learn the history of poker. And then we get into, you know, I say it turns into sort of sociology or psychology or cultural studies, where we talk about kind of the culture of poker, and we read, again, sort of primary texts. So there'll be like things coming from strategy books and memoirs and all sorts of different sources, essays like from academic publications and works, excerpts from anthropological works and all kinds of different things. And then it becomes a literature course, and we read short stories and a novel, and then it becomes a film course, and we watch movies. And so it kind of depends. I think just throwing that huge variety at the students, I think there ends up being something that just about every student will latch onto, that they'll like. And it'll be different for each one. You know, I have some who just, I've had some tell me that their favorite text was, we read Jesse May's novel, Shut Up and Deal, and that's their favorite part of the course. And it's perfect for we read that after we read all this other stuff. And so it like perfectly illustrates all kinds of things that we've been reading about the culture of poker. And he also has that book's written with an awareness of the history of poker too. So that will sort of speak to some students. Others will prefer short stories or some of the McManus. I have them read an excerpt from Dr. Pauly's Las Vegas book. And it's a very, very, what I have them read is an incredibly cynical chapter from his experience covering the 2008 World Series of Poker. And I don't know if you know Dr. Pauly's writings,
yeah.
But he's you know, he's got that kind of Hunter S. Thompson thing going. And
yeah.
They just love this kind of, you know, to read something in a college course where the guy's willing to, you know, curse and tell it like it is, you know, they respond to that. And then there are others who they just can't wait till we get to Rounders. They want to watch the movies, and that's understandable too. So there's a lot that's kind of fun and interesting, and it's fun to teach too.
I don't want to be reductive, and please don't answer this if it's a bad question, but do you have any sort of bumper sticker answers to the question what poker has to teach us about the American psyche?
Yeah, there's probably we read sort of McManus talking about this question, and then Al Alvarez has a nice, I give them an excerpt from a book of his where it's a chapter called The American Game, where he kind of spells out all these different ways poker stands for or is representative of American values. And what I guess the things that, you know, the ideas that I repeat and that we keep going back to throughout the course are these, I put it on the syllabus, kind of at the beginning of the syllabus, where I'm talking about poker as being a game, and quoting various people talking about how it's a game of action and daring and it rewards courage. Think about other sort of American ideas that we sort of associate with America, like independence or freedom or liberty, and how poker can kind of reflect those ideas in different ways, just in the way the game is played, and how it also kind of combines, and I guess this would be the bumper sticker, that it combines a couple of different aspects of America. And this is actually an idea that McManus Ford's in the first chapter of his book, but I borrow it and sort of make it my bumper sticker, where poker is a game that kind of rewards skill. It rewards hard work. It's a game that if you're serious enough about it and you study it, you realize it can be rewarding if you put in the work and the study. And that's something that we like in America, that, you know, the idea of being able to sort of pull yourself up and, you know, improve your situation, that you're not doomed to a certain class because of your birth, but you can actually improve your lot and have the freedom to do so. On the other hand, it's a game that involves luck and chance and gambling, and we like that too. You know, that it's this kind of paradox of America, that we both sort of are, you could even say, risk averse, or that we reward work, and we look at that as sort of the most important thing, that it is you can get rich quick, and that's how some people actually interpret the American dream. As you have all these sort of opportunities all over the place of making a fast buck, and so it combines those in sort of an interesting way. And so that's kind of a lot more than would fit on a bumper sticker, but
well thanks.
Well, we asked you before this interview if there was a book that you recommended or a film that you recommended Nate and I look at and then we could talk about during the interview. And you suggested Al Alvarez's The Biggest Game in Town. Why did you use that book?
Yeah, this is one that I assign in the class. And it's probably the book that I've, you know, as I sort of think of myself as a poker writer or someone, you know, who has reported on poker and gone to the World Series of Poker. It's a book that I think is very inspiring.
You know. So you're kind of following in his footsteps.
Yeah, I mean, Al Alvarez is an Englishman who, you know, was a devoted poker player, and then he came over for the New Yorker, actually, to cover a World Series of Poker, and it was the 1981 World Series of Poker. So we're still talking about when it was a fairly small affair, relatively speaking. And he came over and spent several weeks and wrote this long piece that ended up becoming this book. And it's, you know, it has all the sort of things that I think a creative writer and someone who wants to do something of value and that's lasting, it should inspire a person like that, because it's just such a, you know, it's a definitely a literary take on the World Series of Poker that ends up sort of revealing all kinds of interesting things, not just about the WSOP, but about Las Vegas and about America.
I was really impressed by how much his descriptions of Las Vegas, I mean, not the casinos that he uses to represent, for example, the most touristy part of Las Vegas aren't the casinos that represent that now, but the broader conclusions that he draws about Las Vegas or observations that he makes, they still ring really true to me. I guess it's been 30 plus years since the book was published.
I mean, it's amazing, right? I mean, so the World Series isn't at Binion's anymore. A lot of the players that he's writing about are dead. All sorts of things have changed, but yeah, just so much of the description is just spot on, and so and the prose is so beautiful.
He's definitely tapped into something, I think, and I agree that what he's writing about, you know, he says a lot about the places and the landscape and the, you know, what Vegas looked like when he was there, but he also, he's talking of it, it's the book is about the people and how they are, you know, how they experience Las Vegas and the world of poker and how they're affected by it and what kind of characters are produced by that culture. And all of that is still the case.
Do you think it's something that's being lost as the World Series changes over time? I mean, certainly it's become more commercialized. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. It just in the very literal sense, there's more commerce there and more advertising and things like that. You know, the crowd is different. There are more professional players than there ever were. You know, you have Sasquatch running around giving out beef jerky and things. I mean, do you think that, you know, old men like me who were around the World Series in 2005 remember it pretty differently? Surely you remember a time when the World Series felt, you know, sort of hit your nerve endings a little bit differently from how it does now. Do you think that some of what Alvarez wrote about is being lost or has been lost?
Yeah, I think, you know, he wrote a new introduction for the book where he makes this point. He draws a pretty stark contrast between what the World Series is when he wrote this new introduction, I think just a couple of years ago, and when he was there 30 years ago. And I think that, you know, this sort of, and it, a theme in the book is sort of the difference between, or the romance of the game, you know, which is kind of a catch-all term, but, you know, all of these sort of aspects of poker that connect it with the Old West and, you know, the history of America and all these other sort of values that we were talking about earlier, that this gets diminished and has become less and less part of what's going on, especially at the World Series of Poker. I was mentioning Paul McGuire's book, Las Vegas. That's a great book to look at to sort of read a person, because that book actually starts in 2005 and ends in 2008. And there's a huge change that happens during those years as the World Series moves from Binion's to the Rio, and the commercialization definitely has its effect.
So in your freelancing career, what's either the single most exciting or the single bizarrest thing you've ever seen at a poker table?
I don't know. I'm thinking of unusual things happening, like power outages and strange, unexpected things to happen that caused the tournament to be rescheduled. Probably the most dramatic moment I can think of being at a tournament and covering it was actually Black Friday, was being in Lima, Peru, covering the LAPT event when Black Friday happened, and actually covering it for the Poker Stars blog.
Wow.
And so, you know, we got there and we were starting, I think it was the second day of the event. And then suddenly, you know, we're looking at PokerStars.com and we're seeing the Orwellian FBI, DOJ blocking. And we're wondering what's going on. And, you know, are they going to meet us at the airport and take us away? And, you know, it was a pretty wild, uncertain time.
Unfortunately, a lot of mine are kind of negative. I remember there was a procedural disagreement between Vinnie Vinn and a dealer at the 2005 World Series, and it ended up with the dealer like screaming at him, and the dealer ended up getting fired on the spot, which was not a happy thing to see, but certainly an exciting experience for my first ever main event. The very occasional fight. I mean, these things happen almost never, but when they do, it's pretty remarkable, just because poker can be so steady.
It's an interesting, you know, if you think about it, it's just, it's, you know, the game is fascinating. The routines that are built into the game are so severe, you know, the customs, and there's so much of the game that is by rote that you're right. Anytime anything comes in to disturb that, it just becomes all the more remarkable and memorable. And
well, that has a certain resonance with American culture too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really does. In fact, Heiano, in that book I was talking about, the anthropological study, you know, he basically portrays the lives of these poker pros as pretty desperate, and the routine, you know, just being deadening and without end. That's the big producer of anxiety, is the fact that there's no end to it. You know, the game just keeps going and going and going. And, you know, we'll talk about that in class. We'll read that and talk about it in class. And then I'll say, is this like anything else in American culture? And there are lots of jobs like that, you know, people who are running around in circles, and they do it for many, many years, and then they stop running.
Well, let's see if we can end on a happier note.
Yes.
We talked some about Biggest Game in Town already, and I think that's a pretty well-known poker book. Is there a text out there that you think is kind of underappreciated, or a particularly good poker book or movie that you feel like more people ought to know about?
One book that I like a lot, it's not all about poker, but it's most of it, or about half of it is. It's this book by a writer named John Bradshaw called Fast Company, and it's from the, I think, 1975. And he's kind of, if you like Alvarez, he's a good one to go to after Alvarez, where he basically, it's a collection of six essays about gamblers, and he kind of tries to figure out or explain why they're successful at what they do. And he ends up talking to, actually, Johnny Moss is one of the six, and he actually visits the World Series of Poker and does kind of a similar turn as to what Alvarez did a little later. Titanic Thompson is another one of the people he talks to. But he also talks to, like, Bobby Riggs, the tennis player, who was this incredible character and gambler, and others. And it's, you know, just, again, sort of the great literary writing, character sketches, storytelling, Fast Company by John Bradshaw.
Well, thanks so much for coming on here, Martin.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I think is interesting about Martin is that he's a guy who's just finds the game fascinating for its own sake, and finds the culture of it fascinating, which is what I'm hoping will be a big theme in this podcast, to talk about all the things that are interesting about the culture that surrounds poker, and also the role that poker's played in American culture. But unlike people like, we had Jason Strasser on here last week, who's a professional, or used to be a professional poker player, made a lot of money from poker. When poker is your source of income, or a source of income directly for you like that, then obviously you're going to be interested in poker for self-interested reasons. So I think you get kind of a unique perspective from someone who, you know, he got into poker just because, you know, he started writing a blog. He wasn't a professional poker player. He was just kind of a hobbyist who found poker culture interesting, and he started writing about it. And then, I mean, gradually it's become a bigger part of his career, but his interest is not making money from the game. His interest is, this is just a fascinating subject from kind of an academic perspective and a creative writer's perspective, and he's talking about it and looking at it from those angles, which I think is pretty unique.
Yeah, I mean, the standard for poker writing is so low, and Martin is so good at it, and you just wish he could clone himself and then just have a team of Martins reporting on every tournament that ever happens.
In terms of changes that happened at the WSOP, one of the things I found interesting about the Biggest Game in Town book, and I guess I knew this already about what the WSOP culture used to be like, but even in 1981, there's only 75 people playing the main event. And it's such a kind of chummy, informal thing where it seems like most of them know each other, and they just kind of take a dinner break when they feel like it. At one point, there's a player who, I think they said he had like an allergic reaction or something, and he just sort of like half passed out at the table. And so everyone just kind of decided, oh, we'll take a break. And, you know, an hour later, he's feeling fine, and they resume play. It was all kind of, oh, let's see what we're going to do now. And half the people are playing just because they're friends with Jack Binion. And it does seem like an interesting world. I sort of regret that, not that it would have been at all feasible for me to play a 10K tournament in even in the early 2000s, but just, you know, to have, because I was interested in poker at that time, it would have been pretty interesting to see the tournament when it was a lot smaller.
It was probably 06, which again was like well into the boom. I played with Nick Frangos that year in a stud tournament, and I guess not long ago he'd been asked for an autograph for the first time, and he thought that his friends were playing a prank on him.
I got asked for an autograph once when I was in the top 70 of the 2008. We went on break, and there was someone just kind of grabbing all the people who were clearly players. He had like a copy of, I guess it was probably Card Player magazine, and was just asking everyone he could, all the players he could grab to sign it. So that's the closest I've come to being a recognized.
Thanks again to our listeners, and especially everyone who's emailed. Please keep the emails coming to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Thanks also to Martin Harris for coming and talking poker culture with us, and also to Half Undressed. That's the band you've been listening to. You can check them out at halfundressed.com. Lots of information there, and they also let you download some music for free. And if you live in New York City and like what you hear, head on down to the Cake Shop on Wednesday, because they're playing there as part of the CMJ Music Marathon. That's Wednesday the 17th. If you're in New York, go hear Half Undressed. For all the rest of us, here's a song called Stay Ugly.